Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the latest possible entry into the 2020 presidential race with the former CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, indicating he might run as an independent. Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent for The Week, where he has an article, "The Mueller Investigation is Closing in on Trump," joins us to discuss how the latest billionaire to toy with presidential politics will impact what promises to be a crowded field of Democratic hopefuls running for president in 2020. We'll examine what Ryan Cooper called the presidential delusions of Democratic billionaires in an article he wrote at The Week back in June, and assess the likelihood that the lifelong Democrat Howard Schultz will drain votes from the Democrat running against Trump in 2020, assuming Trump is still in office and not in jail, rewarding him with another term. We'll assess whether billionaires can buy the presidency and whether money is the most important factor in presidential races since Hillary Clinton outspent Trump 2-1, while the alleged billionaire did not spend his own money as promised, but instead the reality TV celebrity attracted $5 billion worth of free media. And with the possibility of over 20 candidates throwing their hats in the ring, we'll separate the workhorses from the show horses and those angling for the vice presidency from those aiming for the top slot. Then, with Speaker Pelosi's office confirming that Trump's State of the Union address scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, will not take place, we'll look into how much Nancy Pelosi is in the driver's seat as a chaotic presidency and a craven Republican Senate lurch from one Trump-manufactured crisis to another. Eric Schickler, a professor of political science at UC Berkeley and author of Investigating the President, Congressional Checks on Presidential Power, joins us to discuss how Pelosi's strategy of not negotiating with Trump is paying off as we await the next government shutdown and emergency declaration Trump has promised for mid-February. Then finally, we will speak with Hans Christensen, director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, about the announcement by the National Nuclear Security Administration that a new low-yield nuclear weapon ordered by Trump is being manufactured. We will assess the dangers of having a more usable 5-kiloton nuclear warhead deployed on a Trident missile and the folly of the Trump administration abandoning the INF treaty with Russia. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And his latest article at The Week is "The Mueller Investigation is Closing in on Trump." Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Ryan. And I called you because you had an article back in June at The Week, "The Presidential Delusions of Democratic Billionaires." And now we know that Howard Schultz is fairly likely, he was on 60 Minutes with a sort of Valentine that they did for him, talking about his, you know, going back in his childhood and how he's abused by his father. It certainly seemed like he was seriously considering entering the race. And of course, he's got a new book out with a coffee-related title, From the Ground Up, and of course the subtitle of it is very revealing, A Journey to Reimagine the Promise of America. So what about these other billionaires? You've got Mark Cuban, who's sort of suggested he might be interested, Michael Bloomberg, and of course the fellow that's running around spending a lot of money on urging the impeachment of Trump, Tom Steyer. So let's start with Schultz. Do you expect him to run?
Well, who knows what these characters are thinking? It's funny, Michael Bloomberg, actually, who is, you know, one of the more just intolerable type of gormless centrist billionaires, put out a statement in reaction to the Schultz sort of pseudo announcement saying, don't do it, buddy. You're just going to split the vote and elect Trump again if you do anything. But it's hard to know the psychology because, you know, these folks, they see Trump's bad. He's very rude. He's very gauche. You know, this racism is all in front instead of being sort of like the kind of Upper West Side liberal of racism, of like frantically mobilizing to keep poor black people out of your school district type of racism. But then you see on the Democratic side, where Obama was basically had the exact same politics as Howard Schultz, the up-and-comers are clearly not against that. You know, AOC and, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and even some of the more centrist people are all, you know, most of them are on Medicare for All. They're talking about a wealth tax or, you know, tax cuts for the middle class, even in the case of Kamala Harris. And so there's sort of being faced with the fact that, like, nobody wants their kind of politics, but it's very easy for people like that, I think, to sort of live in denial. You know, billionaires are very isolated. They have, you know, they're usually surrounded by lickspittles and yes men, you know, who just tell them whatever they want to hear. And especially in the case of a presidential campaign, now you're talking about political consultants who could make bank off of Howard Schultz's campaign, you know, getting like 2% of the vote. And, you know, people's mouths just have to be watering incessantly over that kind of fees they might earn there. But I think that, you know, he doesn't know that what that means. What it means is intense scrutiny. Democrats are going to be furious at him. It's like, who goes to Starbucks? Liberals, you know? And there'd be certainly an attempt at a boycott of Starbucks, you know, any other major investments he happens to own. I know I don't think he's a CEO anymore, but he has major stock holdings in Starbucks. And, you know, people probably picketing his house and, like, throwing rotten tomatoes at him when he's, like, you know, going to the movie theater and stuff for completely understandable reasons, you know, because what he want, you know, what his only possible function could be almost certainly to throw the election to Trump. And number two, his like, program is vapid idiocy. You know, he's like, oh, we need to, you know, the silent majority, you know, which he defines as his own politics, being a sort of vaguely culturally liberal, and yet you want to cut Medicare and Social Security to protect the rich from higher taxes. Literally nobody wants that. Like 75% of Republicans want to protect Medicare and Social Security, and like every single Democrat, more or less. And it's just like, dude.
Well, Ryan Cooper, I mean, you know, I think what's going on here is what's really, I think, going on at the broader level, in the sense that there used to be two centers of power in the United States, Washington and Wall Street. And Wall Street used to basically be subservient, or certainly not submissive, to Washington. But now that's the other way around. I mean, look at the way that Gary Cohn, you know, he comes into the White House. He gets all upset about Trump's cozying up to neo-Nazis at Charlottesville, and huffs and puffs about that, but hangs in there, gets his tax cut for billionaires, and then goes back to Wall Street. If that's not an example of how Wall Street dominates Washington, I don't know what is. And I think that's a reflection of a general attitude that plutocrats and billionaires have about their political hirelings. And you know, most of the Republican Party has sort of been hired by the Koch brothers. And they obviously look down on these people. They don't want smart people in politics. They want malleable toadies that will do their bidding. And I think that's why there's such a paucity of talent in politics.
Yeah, there's an incredible article in Politico today by Ben White, where he basically just went around and talked to a bunch of Wall Street guys about the Democratic primary, and they're like, well, it can't be Sanders or Warren. We got to put a lid on this quick. Like, these other people seem like they'll take, you know, they'll take bribes, more or less, is the subtext of it. But it really illustrates the extent to which these guys really, consciously or unconsciously, they think of themselves as an oligarchy, that they run the country. And it more or less has been the case since 2008, and I think, in the back of these guys' mind, there's the knowledge that in 2008, they wrecked the economy and they kind of had to go hat in hand to the political class and, just like give us basically infinite free money, $700 billion in cash and how many, God knows, like $29 trillion in loans and such to keep the thing from collapsing. And that's what they got, just total deference from them, even to the extent of not prosecuting anybody for their horrible systematic foreclosure fraud. One guy got prosecuted. My mistake was out of the maybe 20,000 people. But, I think it tends to make people a little hysterical, these Wall Street guys, and maybe a little more like aggressive in the case possibly of Howard Schultz, of like, could we really have to reassert our control? It reminds me of Steve Schwarzman in 2010, I believe. He said that Obama's proposal to close the carried interest loophole, that is to say, to make it so that private equity hedge fund guys have to pay the same tax on their income as other people who make ordinary income, which is what they're making, is analogous to Hitler's invasion of Poland. And like I think there's a sense that's percolating among this class that their grip on power is in fact kind of tenuous. And if they don't just constantly beat back, the proles or the rabble, then, their fortunes could be they could be modestly eroded, which is for them like worse than death, basically.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And his latest article at The Week is The Mueller Investigation is Closing in on Trump. So just in looking at those entering the race so far, and as you pointed out, Howard Schultz running as independent is likely to drain votes from Democrats and help reelect Trump, assuming he's still in the race or still in the office. So Kamala Harris is at a big rally in Oakland over the weekend. Seems like she's moving ahead. I'd interviewed somebody the other day from San Francisco who looked into her record, a law professor there, and a lot of people rotting in jail thanks to Kamala Harris, who shouldn't be in jail. So she's going to have some problems with the progressive wing of the party explaining how she was a progressive prosecutor, as she claims to be in a new autobiography. But a lot of them seem to be, some of them at least, seem to be running as vice president or for the vice president, like that Julian Castro. So how do you see the field in terms of those that seem to want it both ways? They run as a president and then they get sort of packaged as a vice president if they ethnically or gender-wise balance out the ticket.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, I kind of think that a lot of these folks, they really don't even know in their own mind what they're going to do. I mean, one person who's definitely just aiming for a higher profile is that Pete Buttigieg. I don't even know how to pronounce it. The mayor of like South Bend, Indiana.
Oh, the gay mayor, right?
Yeah, and he's clearly not going to win. Nobody's heard of him. But in my sense is that you have a sort of tier of people who are running, they're running to win and they're running in a sort of definitely populist vein in two different ways. But that's Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. They're more or less, I would say, in the same general tendency, even though their politics are not significantly different. Then you have the sort of like centrists who are running to win. I think Kamala Harris is running to win. I think Gillibrand's running to win. Then I would say that, yeah, that more or less most of the rest of the field, they would definitely, you know, I think that in the age of Trump, everyone has in the back of their head, it's like, well, if he made it, maybe I could make it. But in the same time, you know, kind of your Sherrod Browns or your
Elizabeth
Julian
Warren.
Castro.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Warren, I think, is running for, well, she's running for the presidency, undoubtedly. And probably Sherrod Brown will, won't he? Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, insofar as they toss their hat into the ring, Castro, obviously, is a very pretty marginal figure in the party at this point. But I think the sort of president-vice president thing, it's really going to just depend on how they do. You know, it's like if people really catch fire and they manage to rack up tons of delegates, if I had to guess, and this is completely ridiculous in terms of predictive, confidence, but the nominee will be in first place and the vice president will be in second place. And just whoever that ends up being. And, you know, it's hard to know because it seems like a lot of the Clinton folks are coalescing around, Kamala Harris, but she is already kind of running to the center. Like she was for, free tuition college, now it's debt-free college, more conservative policy. And her big thing now is a big tax cut for the middle class, which would be paid for by raising it on the rich. But on the other hand, it also leaves out the very poor deliberately because it's based on the EITC. And, yeah, as you said, she's got a lot of Even isn't, you know, in interviews, isn't really running away from her record as sort of like tough on crime exactly. She's saying like, well, for criminals, I always seek the toughest possible sentence. That was on an interview on MSNBC the other day, and it's pretty hard to tell who's it's so wide open, you know, like you might as well bust out your Ouija board and sort of try to divine what the spirits would say.
Well, it's pretty depressing that in the last presidential election, the front runner ran such a terrible campaign that she allowed this catastrophe to happen with Trump.
Yeah.
And then you got all these people crowding around trying to beat. And then it's not going to be the same as the 2016 Republican primary debates where a reality TV star knocked all the other ones off the island because he knew how to be a reality TV star and how to get free publicity. They're all, because they're all Democrats, they're all going to be sort of reasonable and polite. So I don't see that kind of attrition happening. So it'll just grind on, won't it, as opposed to get some early clarity?
Well, I mean, I think the field will probably consolidate, you know, after the first few primaries. You know, there's going to be people who win by a considerable margin. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes from like 10 to 4 over the first, once the actual elections start happening. But yeah, I think it's going to be pretty grim. You know, there's going to be so many debates, and I think as people are like sort of fading, they may get desperate and start attacking the other people. And, you know, the social media dynamics that I could see happening on Twitter and Facebook are already incredibly toxic. That you know, people will sort of just try to win by saying that everyone else is a racist or misogynist. If, you know, you don't support Gillibrand or you don't support Harris or.
Well, just in the last minute, I just wanted to touch on your article, the Mueller investigation is closing in on Trump. That may well be the biggest factor, right? I mean, making all of this talk about the Democrats running for president somewhat moot. They might be running against Mike Pence.
Very true, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it sort of depends on before the shutdown, I would have said just with total confidence that no way Republicans would ever sort of put any pressure on Trump to leave office. But this shutdown really dented his popularity, and it was starting to sink even among Republicans by that point. And, you know, you could see the thing where if he insists on pushing another shutdown and there's some like very serious disruption of the economy, and then at the same time, or like maybe a little bit afterwards, Mueller comes out with some sort of smoking gun that Trump did like terrible crimes or, you know, definitely you know, conspired with Russian intelligence to win, then they might, you know, people might start making kind of calculations. I'd still be very surprised to see that, you know. I don't, you know, the just knee-jerk defense of Trump has been so consistent, but I wouldn't entirely rule it out at this point. And in that case, you know, I mean, you saw what happened to Gerald Ford. It's just Pence is, you know, he's involved with that scandal too. And then you would have a very demoralized Republican Party. You know, there would certain to be a tremendous infighting about that, and I think it would be in almost worse shape than that. But, you know, can only really wait and see, I guess, at this point.
Well, Ryan Cooper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And his latest article at The Week is The Mueller Investigation is Closing in on Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing how Nancy Pelosi's strategy of not negotiating with Trump is paying off.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidi-bidi-rich idle-diddle-diddle-diddle man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Schickler, who is a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Disjointed Pluralism, Institutional Innovation and the Development of the U.S. Congress, Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate, and Investigating the President, Congressional Checks on Presidential Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Schickler.
Thanks, Ian.
And there's been some checks on presidential power lately, somewhat overdue. Nancy Pelosi does seem to have been the first person to really pull Donald Trump over. And it doesn't look like he's going to do the State of the Union. Tomorrow is scheduled. I'm not sure when that'll be. But the question I would have, Eric, is looking at what happened with the Trump shutdown and the 35 days of government employees not getting paid, and then this kind of sort of wimpy ending, if you will, or, you know, it ended with a whimper as opposed to a bang. You have to ask yourself, what was it all about?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, certainly some people around President Trump are probably asking that question. And I think that, you know, it's an example of the danger of getting into a showdown where you don't have a clear exit strategy or political strategy. And I think that the White House in this case, you know, really did kind of blunder into this, where President Trump, if you go back to before Christmas, was really likely to sign the bill that, you know, there was a bill to keep the government open that passed the Senate and that was going to go to the House. And, you know, McConnell wouldn't have let it pass the Senate if he didn't expect the president to sign it. And all of a sudden, Trump got this uproar from the far right and basically said he wouldn't sign it, so Paul Ryan killed it. But they all did that without really any clear plan as to how they'd get a better bill from their standpoint out of the new Congress, particularly with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker.
So it does seem, though, that Nancy Pelosi, her strategy of no negotiating was very successful. She was able to keep her caucus in line. Apparently, a lot of them were nervous. The Blue Dogs on one side were nervous, and the more progressive new crop of Democratic freshmen were also nervous. But at a closed-door meeting with the House Democrats last Wednesday, Speaker Pelosi defended her no-negotiating strategy by saying, "Understand, there is a plan. It's working for us." And she recounted how they beat back, the Democrats beat back President George W. Bush's efforts to privatize Social Security in 2005 by staying unified and having a simple message, much like they were doing in this recent shutdown. And they did the same when Republicans shut down the government in 2013, trying to defund Obamacare, and they didn't counter Republicans then. Pelosi noted, and she said, well, ultimately, they won. So no question that she's good at what she does. So do you think all of that sort of talk about her being too old and all of that idea that maybe she wouldn't even get the vote to become Speaker again, is that all, do you think, gone by the wayside?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, you know, she fended back that challenge pretty effectively, you know, in November and December, and showed her skill at, you know, basically cutting deals where she needed to and also showing toughness where appropriate. And, you know, I think her selling point to members as to why she should be Speaker is she understands how the House works. She understands, you know, what you need out of a leader in kind of dealing with a president of the other party, and that she's ready to do that and is willing to take the political heat necessary to do that. And, you know, I think this was essentially a case in point. You know, if she, no better illustration for her argument as to why, you know, she was the kind of logical person for the party to have as Speaker.
Well, a lot of people consider that the Vice President, Mike Pence, is not quite as incendiary and is not attracting quite the anger and anxiety that Donald Trump is provoking in terms of a growing opposition, where you've got a majority of Americans who definitely don't like him, and many of them would want him to go right away. Do you see any chance that you could get a twofer here, that somehow if Trump is forced to resign or slinks away in disgrace, that that would also rub off on the vice president, that he would be equally contaminated, and would we end up with Nancy Pelosi, or is that a fantasy?
I'm afraid that is probably, you know, is not in the cards. I mean, I think, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens with President Trump in terms of the investigations, the Mueller report, and so on. I mean, I think, you know, there is, you know, there certainly is the possibility that the House will consider impeachment. And then if the, you know, it'll take an awful lot to get those Republican votes you would need in the Senate to actually convict. But, you know, who knows what would happen there. I think it's unlikely that that Pence would be so caught up and tarnished that he wouldn't be able to serve. I think, though, the big question would be, you know, politically, in terms of the 2020 election, you know, would he be heard at that point? In other words, so it's not going to lead to President Pelosi, but in terms of looking ahead to 2020 and the various Democratic candidates, you know, clearly the atmosphere of scandal and ineffectiveness around the White House is going to help the hopes of those, you know, many Democratic aspirants for 2020.
Well, apparently the CBO said that this shutdown, this 35-day government shutdown, where about 800,000 federal workers were not being paid and were furloughed, it cost the U.S. economy about $3 billion, although apparently there's a chance that there may be up to $8 billion later calculated as a loss. Apparently, Trump has been sliding in the polls. So what's your sense of where we stand in terms of this odd situation in the United States where you essentially have the tyranny of the minority? You have about 30% of Americans determining the fate of the 70% because of the 30% in the Fox News bubble that are immune to facts and evidence, who support Trump zealously and blindly.
You know, well, I mean, I think we'll, you know, a lot of this history remains to be written. I think it's clear that the president is in a much weakened position right now. His ability to get any kind of legislative program through, you know, is extremely limited. His ability to just run the bureaucracy in a kind of competent, effective way is also quite limited, you know, just by the sheer amount of turnover and the kind of the quality of people he's appointed. And really the one area in which he's able to continue to exercise a lot of influence is judicial nominations, where with Republicans still in control of the Senate, they're still able to pursue that agenda effectively. I think, you know, ultimately, that's kind of the state of play. I do agree that there's some base of the country, I think it's probably close to about 35-38%, that is never going to abandon the president. On the other hand, having it be that small does limit what can be done, particularly, again, now that Democrats control the House, so that what we're likely to have is quite a lot of gridlock, and then there's an opportunity in 2020 for some, you know, genuine change to happen.
Well, this new Washington Post ABC poll, so just some of the points that are revealed. 57% rate Trump's handling of border security negatively, and that's, of course, his signature issue. 61% say Trump is not honest or trustworthy. 58% say Trump lacks the personality and temperament to serve effectively as president. 56% say Trump has not brought needed change to Washington. 65% say Trump does not understand the problems of people like them. 58% say Trump is not good at making political deals. And 64% do not have a lot of confidence that Trump will make the right decisions for the country's future. So again, it does seem a little like we're in some kind of Alice in Wonderland situation where you've got a president in power, his base sticking by him, the Democrats have the House, the Republicans have the Senate, the majority of the country are not happy, to say the least, with the president. So, and you've got, 20 plus Democratic challengers lining up for 2020. So what's your expectation in terms of ending this, what I consider to be a tyranny of the minority?
Well, I mean, I think that there's, you know, probably two main paths ahead for the next, you know, year or so. One is, you know, the Mueller report ends up providing enough ammunition, plus when combined with investigations that the Democratic House will lead, to have, you know, a serious drive at impeachment, and then we'll just have to see where that leads. I think the other path is that we kind of continue to kind of hobble along where we are with Trump holding onto his base but not able to accomplish much of anything other than, again, this point about judicial nominations. And then, you know, pretty soon, by the time you get to 2020, the start of 2020, everybody's focus is on the next election. And, you know, there'll be the question, is there a primary challenge to Trump within the Republican Party? Which of the Democrats emerges as his main challenger? And that's really where the focus is going to be. And again, we'd have to see how it all plays out. But I guess the optimistic note I would strike for opponents of the critics, you know, the president, is like neither of these scenarios are particularly promising for President Trump. It's just a matter of, you know, does it end in a kind of short-term disaster for him, or does he hobble along for another 18 months until there's this election? I mean, obviously, one might say that for the country, this current, you know, hobbling along is not a good thing, but I think that those are essentially the two likely paths.
Well, apparently, President Trump has his whiteboard in his office or off the Oval Office. He's got this big bank of TV sets, but he's also got this whiteboard that says promises made, promises kept, and he's listed all these things. And the big one, of course, is the wall. And this 35-day shutdown, which ended in a capitulation on his part, the best he could offer was that in the middle of February, we're going to go through this agony again. And this time, if he doesn't get his $5.7 billion, he's going to declare a national emergency. So what's your expectation there? I mean, do you think we'll actually go those threats? He wasn't entirely convincing in his interview with the Wall Street Journal that he was going to play hardball in that way, but that's the promise, and that looks like the future. And again, it makes you wonder, what are we doing here? What kind of government is this there where you shut it down for 35 days, achieve nothing, and then the best you can say is in another three weeks, I'm going to shut it down again?
Yeah, no. Well, so I guess I'd say one thing is, you know, I'm hesitant to try to predict President Trump's ultimate behavior and decision-making because, You know, clearly there's a whole lot of unpredictability there. But I think the best guess right now is to say that that's just bluster, and that if he didn't make a national emergency declaration already, it seems unlikely he's going to do that in February. And that the most likely scenario as to what will happen in mid-February is Mitch McConnell will go to him and say, you know, take whatever fig leaf you can get, because we're not going to have the votes to keep the government shut down. The Republicans in the Senate are not going to play the same game that they did in early January. And so I think he's going to be stuck, and he will try to find some face-saving way to declare victory without actually getting much at all or anything really quote-unquote concrete out of it. But I think that's the most likely scenario. But I'll say, with the reservation that with President Trump, you know, you never know for sure what he's going to do.
Well, finally, do you think that Nancy Pelosi can basically ignore him? I mean, that seems to be implicit in her no negotiation strategy. It's pretty clear that she spent time with him as a Schumer. They know how strange and mercurial and ill-informed, and she's basically said, you know, without, in a polite way, that, you know, you can't have a meeting with this guy because he doesn't have a baseline of facts. He has all these weird ideas he gets from Alex Jones and other crackpots. And if you do make a deal with him, 10 minutes later, he watches Fox News and tears up the deal.
Yeah, you know, I think that Pelosi has likely hit on a good strategy for dealing with President Trump, which I think, you know, she kind of lays out her position. She shows that she's not going to give, you know, ground when she doesn't need to, and kind of, and almost, I don't want to say traps him, but, you know, almost welcomes him. She and Schumer, you know, in that first meeting at the White House, did a really nice job of kind of provoking him, getting him, prodding him to talk and make that statement, you know, it's going to be my shutdown, I'll own this. And, you know, I think that was in some sense a product of Pelosi's having kind of in some sense challenged him at that meeting. And so I think I do think she kind of understands him and realizes that just engaging in the normal back and forth negotiation just is not going to be fruitful. And so I think that the approach of, you know, kind of drawing a firm line as to where she stands and then kind of trying to keep her party on that message is likely to continue working.
Well, Eric Schickler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Schickler, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Disjointed Pluralism, Institutional Innovation and the Development of the U.S. Congress, Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate, and Investigating the President, Congressional Checks on Presidential Power. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the new low-yield nuclear weapon ordered by Trump is now being manufactured. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Hans Christensen, who's the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, where he provides the public with analysis and background information about the status of nuclear forces and the role of nuclear weapons. He previously was a consultant to the nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council and was also a senior researcher with the Nuclear Information Unit of Greenpeace International in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hans Christensen.
Thanks for having me.
So, Hans, what do you make of the email that's coming out from the Trump administration's National Nuclear Security Administration announcing that they are starting to manufacture the new nuclear weapon that Donald Trump ordered, a low-yield nuclear weapon, which many people feel is actually a more usable nuclear weapon and therefore an incredibly dangerous development?
Well, so I guess the first surprise is that it is so quick. It's only a year ago that we had the nuclear post review. And normally these systems take a longer time to develop. But so this speaks to what's going on, which is a modification of an existing warhead, where they're taking a warhead that has a thermonuclear warhead that has two components in it, and a maximum yield of about 100 kiloton, and they turn off one of the components and get a much lower yield, probably in the order of 5 to 7 kiloton. And so that's sort of, half of the Hiroshima bomb power. And it's only a small number that is going to be produced of these. It's sort of a, what I wouldn't call it sort of a serious military requirement. It's more sort of a, what you could call a show, a demonstration of intent as part of this new effort of the Trump administration's nuclear post review to sort of stand up to the Russians on the issue of them potentially using low yield nuclear weapons first in a conflict. So the authors of the nuclear post review believe that the United States should do something similar, where it produces a low yield weapon for its ballistic missile submarines and then threaten them with that. This is not by any means the first or the only low-yield nuclear weapon that the United States has in its stockpile. By my count, the U.S. has about 1,000 other warheads for cruise missiles and gravity bombs that have low-yield options, too. So it's not like the United States doesn't have this type of an option.
Right, but this is this going to be on the Trident missile?
This is going on the Navy's strategic submarine missiles. So this raises a number of questions, of course, about what I would call sort of mission creep, where it shows that at least the planners who support this mission are envisioning and using strategic fast-flying ballistic missiles in a different way than they've been used before. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't develop it. So this raises a number of questions about usability of nuclear weapons. What are we signaling to adversaries that we're up to? Of course, officials are insisting that this doesn't mean the United States is lowering the threshold for potential nuclear weapon use, which would always be a tough decision to make politically. But it can certainly signal to other countries that the United States is considering using nuclear weapons, strategic nuclear weapons, earlier in a conflict than previously.
Well, isn't there an inherent danger, though? If you launch a Trident missile, then, the Russians, and obviously you're not necessarily going to launch it against Russia or a Russian target, but in any other target, nevertheless, the Russians know that signature. We know that because when Yeltsin was president, a Norwegian research missile went up, and the Russians thought it was a Trident coming their way. It was the first time that the Cheget, the Russian equivalent of their football, was used, and Yeltsin was faced with this extraordinary choice, do I retaliate? And then mercifully they realized the missile trajectory wasn't heading in their direction, and the crisis was over. So to my mind, there's no way to know whether a Trident missile has 100 kilotons warhead or a 5 kiloton warhead.
No. I mean, these things probably only matter for real in inside the heads of strategists. The point being that, like you're correctly saying, if a ballistic missile was launched from a submarine and it was heading somewhere onto the territory of a country, that country would obviously have to assume the worst. I mean, we would. So, you know, this the Russians, of course, are doing their own dirty work. I mean, they're also developing weapons and have been for a long time, weapons that have low yield capability and appear intended to be used if necessary. And so, you know, many nuclear weapon states are doing similar things. What's particularly new, though, is the fact that this new weapons program, breaks with what has been long-term U.S. policy after the end of the Cold War, which was not to introduce weapons that have new military capabilities or entertain new military missions for nuclear weapons. So this seems to break with that policy.
But what do we know about Russian low-yield nuclear weapons? Are they in their intermediate nuclear forces, short-range missiles, or?
Yeah, they don't use low-yield for their strategic forces, and neither do we. Although, of course, there are options in the cruise missiles for the long-range bombers that have, where the warheads, some of the warheads have low-yield settings or or options, but, you know, there are several options that go from low to high. But this is mainly a feature that has been used in tactical nuclear weapons over the years. Although, I mean, I have to say that there is a lot of overlap in these things. It's not a black and white entirely, but it's predominantly been a feature of sort of tactical nuclear weapons. And so here the Russians have introduced, both during the Cold War, but also in several cases after the end of the Cold War, introduced nuclear weapon systems with short range or medium range that have that have the low yield options. So this is something they contemplate using in their strategy. The question is, how can one best counter that and try to work against that type of development? And so there are people in our camp, the U.S. Nuclear planning and policy planning community, who believe that now that the Russians are doing that, we need to do it too. And I think, and many others think, that it's a mistake to sort of buy into President Vladimir Putin's way of thinking on this. The U.S. military has been planning military options to counter weapons like that for several decades. It didn't require parity, didn't require introduction of new low-yield nuclear weapons. And so this is sort of a worrisome trend to go back to the old ways to some degree of tit-for-tat.
Well, the old ways, going back to the Cold War, because the U.S. had a lot of tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, the most ridiculous of all, if you can use that word, was the Davy Crockett, which was literally a bazooka that fired a low-yield nuclear weapon. It seemed almost like it was user-unfriendly.
Yeah.
So we've had that whole nightmare before. But my understanding about this new nuclear weapon that Donald Trump ordered and now is going into production at the Pantex nuclear weapons plant in Texas, if you take away the secondary, the outer jacket, that tritium deuterium that gives you the thermonuclear blast, and it's triggered by the fission trigger, is essentially a neutron bomb. So I don't understand how, you know, what this weapon is, because if you take away the secondary for a thermonuclear device, you actually have the equivalent of a neutron bomb, which is low yield, but not the same as the low yield tactical weapons that we had during the Cold War. And as you mentioned, there's at least 1,000 of them still in the U.S. inventory.
Well, the primary that drives the plutonium primary is not a neutron bomb. It produces a fission yield of about 5-plus kiloton. And its only function in the weapon, so to speak, is to drive the secondary and create enough heat and neutron intensity that it starts burning the fuel in the secondary. And so the neutron bomb is a very different types of weapons that's specifically intended to have a very, very, very small yield, but a high burst of radiation from it. So that's a different type of technology. But this primary here is a primary that uses the same basic principles as all the other weapons that had tactical capability and low yield, to the extent they were, you know, implosion weapons driven by plutonium. Mm. So it continues that. My concern with it, of course, is that it introduces, and I have to say, I don't believe the intention here is that they now suddenly want to use these weapons in sort of a battlefield way that we had during the Cold War. I don't think that's the intention. But it is definitely the intention to use them potentially, or signal that they can use them in a different way that we would otherwise use nuclear weapons on the Trident submarines.
So let's talk about the arms control regime and what's left of it now that the U.S. is building new nuclear weapons. And just that in itself is something that I think worries a lot of people, me included. The reason that the U.S. says it's going to get out of the, or Trump says he's going to get out of the INF treaty, is because the Russians have broken it with a new cruise missile. The Russian Defense Ministry took the wraps off this new cruise missile, the SSC-8, on January the 23rd, and they're challenging the U.S. argument that this violates the INF treaty. What do you make of that?
Well, the Russians, as far as I can gauge from people I've talked to, were caught red-handed and did, in fact, develop a capability that we're not allowed to develop under the INF treaty. And then they've been disputing that in various ways. First, they disputed that there even was such a missile, and then the U.S. disclosed the name of the missile. Then they admitted there was a missile by that name, but it didn't have as long a range. Then the U.S. added more information that, they had tested this weapon in specific ways to conceal the fact that it had a longer range. Then the Russians do this, public relations show we saw recently in Moscow, where they displayed two canisters, missile canisters, as well as a launcher, and claim that is this particular missile and its launcher. Of course, they didn't display any missiles. They displayed the canisters for what they said were for the missiles. And the launcher is, a launcher that appears to be either identical to a land-based system called the CLUP-M and might have been converted from that particular launcher to this new cruise missile. So, of course, their demonstration didn't prove or disprove anything. It was just a display of equipment. And so it was a public relations show. And that is what they're trying to accomplish. And so the Trump administration, for its part, is playing hardball and threatening to withdraw from the treaty, because unless the Russians destroy these missiles the U.S. says they have. And so that's where we are right now, going back and forth and sort of, two kids in a sandbox throwing things at each other.
Right, but what's completely illogical about getting out of the INF treaty is that as long as you're in the treaty, you're able to complain, which is what the U.S. is doing.
It doesn't make any sense to withdraw from it at all.
Right.
The point is that the policy or the objective of the United States is to try to persuade Russia to come back into compliance. That is also the objective and the goal of our NATO allies. So it makes no sense to withdraw from the treaty, because if you withdraw from the treaty, there is no treaty that Russia can return to compliance with. So it's sort of a self-contradictory type of policy. So instead, the U.S. should stay in the treaty. It should continue to build the pressure, provide the evidence, and challenge Russia and work the issue. I mean, that's the way you do these things, not by slamming the door.
Well, the rationale, from what I understand, is, or at least the reason for why the U.S. is threatening to get out of the INF, has more to do with China than Russia, doesn't it?
Well, that's because, again, it depends who you ask. And right now there's an opportunity for people who would like to see some more military strike capability to go into the Pacific. There's an opportunity for those people to come out and say, this is actually what it's really about, and you know, let's get out of this tree so we can stand up to China. But that's not what drove this deliberation. What clearly drove it was the battle with Russia. The U.S. military would never have gotten permission to build in and deploy land-based stuff in the Pacific had it not been for this opportunity to get out of the INF treaty. So I think that's sort of a – you can always find people who want more options, more capabilities, what have you. But the fact is that the U.S. military has been planning for more than two decades to respond to China's INF range weapons without having to rely on U.S. ground-launched missiles. They've been doing it with air and sea-based systems. And so that's the way they've done it. That's the way they've been able to do it. Now there are some people who want more stuff, and I think that's really what's going on.
Well, just in closing, apparently Trump has a morbid fascination with nuclear weapons. When the first day after he got elected, he was given a briefing, and he kept asking the briefing, you know, they wanted to tell him about what's happening in the world, and he kept wanting to talk about what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. And he also, many times, when he was sort of playing around with running for president, he kept talking about how he could solve the nuclear weapons crisis with Russia because he's a great negotiator. This is at the time of Reagan and Gorbachev. So that's what I find disturbing, is you got somebody with a morbid fascination with nuclear weapons ordering a new weapon and tearing up an important treaty.
Yeah, I mean, he's an oddball in many levels, because I mean, on the one hand, he's been talking about, you know, he's been focused on issues of, you know, who has the biggest nuclear button, and, you know, we can rain terror and fear and fire and all this kind of bombastic sort of chest thumping language. On the other hand, he's been talking about from time to time that, you know, he would like to see to normalize relations with Russia. He would like to see relaxed relations. He would like to see reduced numbers of weapons if we can just make the other weapon states come with us, et cetera, et cetera. So he sort of uses both sides from time to time. But I would say in balance, of course, he's been mostly characterized by this bombastic type of language and sort of simplistic way of looking at things. So I think his choice to sort of say, you know, we'll just leave the INF treaty is sort of a typical, you know, I don't want to bother. This is the way I think things work. You know, I stand up, I'm tough, and not this boring stuff about spending years working the issue and trying to have diplomats influence and interact with the other country that you have issues with. That's the way it should be done, but that doesn't seem to appeal to him.
Well, Hans Christensen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Hans Christensen, who's the director of the Nuclear Information Project of the Federation of American Scientists, where he provides the public with analysis and background information about the status of nuclear forces and the role of nuclear weapons. He previously was a consultant to the nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council and was also a senior researcher with the Nuclear Information Unit of Greenpeace International in Washington, D.C. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.